Now is the last morning talk on Sunday of this November 2009 retreat. And first of all, you notice how fast that time has gone. You know, 9 days go so quickly, and so just the rest of your life, it's almost over. We do go on very quickly, and time passes so fast. And of course, the last talk which I give on these retreats, we always talk about, you know, how do you take these teachings and this practice back home with you? You know, what's the best thing to do next? And of course, the best thing to do is don't leave. But that's not really possible for most of you. Although some of you are going to be carrying on here. And that's one of the greatest benefits of this retreat centre. Not just that you've got your own rooms or the food, or Bianca's work is just brilliant. But the fact that, you know, if you want to, you can actually stay a bit longer. And all the other retreats we used to hire, as soon as it got to Sunday afternoon, get out. Because they had to make use of the place for the next group of people coming. But here, on these retreats we have here, because this is our own place, you know, people can come a bit earlier, they can stay a bit later. And it's such a wonderful thing that you can extend the retreat if you really want to. So that story, which about the Korean monk, and it was saying, oh, you know, we're going to stay an extra couple of weeks. You know, here, you know, you can stay in a couple of weeks, and those who want to get out as soon as possible can. So it's a win-win for both sides. But most of you will be going home and going back to work and going back to your families. And it's important to know that what you've heard here and what you've learnt here will actually stay with you. I mentioned that many of the things which I heard, you know, living with Ajahn Chah or with other great people, those teachings at the time, I thought I wouldn't remember. You know, they did sort of go in there. I didn't understand them. They weren't really important. I thought I forgot them. But there is something called, you know, conditioning, what I call brainwashing here. But all those messages get in there, and they're stored. And they're stored in your memory bank, and they come up just at the time you need them. You know, little things like just letting go. There's one of the people who comes regularly to Nolamara, and she told me that she was bringing food. I think she was taking food back from, brought food to Bodhinyana Monastery. And on the way back, you know, she lost her concentration a little bit and went off the edge of the road, and her car turned. And it rolled over 3 or 4 times. And as it was turning over, you know, 3 or 4 times, she thought she was going to die. And so she just said, I'll let go, let go, let go. And it came automatically to her. You know, in that time, you can't sort of think, what should I do next? You know, you're in a car and it's rolling. And you think you're going to die. And she said, it's a wonderful experience. She wasn't badly injured at all. She was very lucky. The car was a write-off. But she remembered, told me afterwards, it was amazing that when it really mattered, you know, she remembered those things, all the things which she was taught. And that will happen to you. Now, many of these stories, many of these pieces of advice, you know, you think, well, how can I remember all of them? Well, you try and write them down. But writing them down, you've got so many books, you can't find the book later on. But you don't really need to write them down, because they actually do get stored inside. And especially some of the teachings I've given here, you know, not just about sort of ordinary life, they're about meditation and some of the deep meditations as well. And some of those you may think you understand, but you know, you don't really understand them yet, but they go into your mind. And then especially when the mind gets into that area where those instructions can be useful, you remember them. Which is why I teach like this, why I teach all people. And if you may be just coming here for your first retreat ever, I teach everybody about nimittas and jhanas, even enlightenment experiences and things disappearing. You may think that's so far away from you, but it does happen. Just one day, maybe 5 to 10 years from now, that happens to you. And a thought will come up into your mind, oh, just be like a monk sitting by a still forest pool. And you won't remember where you heard that from. But you know its meaning. It's in there. And it will help you on those important stages just before you get into the powerful deep meditations. It's also I've taught like this, you know, because, you know, people deserve to know. Someone told me that they were part of a Mahayana tradition before, and in the Mahayana tradition, they weren't allowed to to read books on jhanas. There were some published, but then they were confiscated afterwards by the monks, saying, no, this is a teaching only for monastics and not for lay people. And I thought, when I heard that, I thought, there's something wrong with that. Even if, you know, the jhanas are beyond some people, it doesn't matter, at least you should know about them. Because we're not supposed to hide anything. One of the great teachings of the Buddha, he closed his fist and he said, I don't teach with a closed fist, keeping information back from people. I just teach with an open hand. So people ask, I tell. Will you believe it or not? Or accept it or not? Or understand it or not? That's not the point. You might understand it later. But teach it openly, so people ask, you say. So that's why I've taught like this. And there's another reason why I've taught like this, not just to give you information, big information, just out of respect for you, but also that when you talk about these high states of mind, I know you're going to aspire towards them, even though I tell you not to. But because of that, you actually go far deeper in meditation when you hear there's a possibility of nimittas and jhanas. And if I just, talk to the low level and just said, oh, just make your mind peaceful, just be in the moment, that's all you need to do. By mentioning these things, the mind actually does go into deeper meditations than you would have got into otherwise. So even though you may not have got into a jhana, you may not have got into a nimitta, don't be concerned about that. Because I've mentioned that, many of you have got far deeper meditations than you've ever had before, and that's enough. And that's wonderful. Many of you have got great insights, into your body, into your nature, into the past, into all sorts of things. And that's wonderful. Even though I've never called this an insight meditation retreat, you've all got great understandings through this retreat. You have had insights, but you haven't gone searching for those insights or trying to make them happen. They've happened as a natural course of what we've been doing here. There's another simile of insight which is nice to bring up now. This is one of Ajahn Chah's similes. He said in these monasteries, in the northeast of Thailand, they're in sort of jungles which are being preserved, and the paddy fields have grown around them, but the paddy fields have stopped at the edge of the monasteries because the monasteries belong to the monks. So these are little islands of what used to be jungle spread throughout the northeast. And he said, in those jungle paths, you had to have paths to your huts and to the halls and the toilets. In those paths, it was like a very white, sandy soil in the northeast. And so, you'd have to sweep those paths every day, to get the leaves off. It wasn't just to find your way through the jungle, but it was also to make sure that, you didn't tread on snakes or scorpions or ants. Because in the forest you couldn't see, a snake from a stick, you could hardly notice it. But on the clear paths, it's white sand, you could actually see where you were treading. And he said that, every day we'd always spend an hour or two sweeping those paths. And I remember that as a young monk. And when we were sweeping the paths, a Westerner, you're a perfectionist, you sweep the path, and you go about 10 metres, turn around and see a leaf had dropped right in the middle of the path you just swept. Now most Thai people would just carry on, that's nature, but me, I had to turn around and get that one leaf, to make it perfect. It's a crazy mind we have, but that's how we've been trained. We swept a path, and one leaf falls on it, no, I've got to go back and pick it up. But Ajahn Chah saw that, and he made this beautiful simile. He said, look, if a leaf falls, on a path with thousands of other leaves, or in the jungle, you don't notice it. But if one leaf falls on a path which is cleared of all leaves, it really stands out. He said, that's how insight works. You sweep your mind clean, so there's hardly any thoughts, nothing in there. And so when the first leaf experience falls into your empty mind, it really stands out. You can see it clearly. It's not complicated with all these other leaves and twigs. It's just one leaf on an empty path. So when you are still and empty, just one experience, even one thought, one emotion of anger or joy which comes up, because it's surrounded by emptiness, by nothing, it really stands out and you can see it clearly for what it is, with no complications. So that's actually another reason why insight happens when you have a very free, peaceful and empty meditation retreat. Now there's nothing going on, so when something does happen, you can see it clearly. In your daily life, there's so many other things going on. Gee, it's amazing you can see anything. It's just a mess and a tangle of events which you have to try and unentangle. You're so busy. So during this retreat, you have got many insights. And those insights, whether they're profound insights into the nature of existence, or just simple insights into how to deal with the pain of your body, or how to deal with like, the comments which you receive in life, those insights, whether they're very profound or you think very basic, are all incredibly useful. You know, the book which I wrote, Opening the Door of Your Heart, you know, some people think, oh, that's a nice, fun book to read, you know, a few jokes and a few sort of simple stories. And you know, they think, oh, that's just for lay people, if they're monks. But no. Some of those stories in there, they may be sort of what you think are ordinary insights, like the two bad bricks in the wall or something, but you apply that to all stages of your meditation. Give you an example. Nimittas. This brilliant stage, which is incredibly powerful and deep, when you're just on the doors of jhana and the enlightenment, which is beyond. When those nimittas come up, you know, for those of you who had these nimittas, you look at that, and there's always two bad bricks in there, two little faults. And if you don't understand the meaning of that simile, the two bad bricks in the wall, the mind would straight away go to the faults and defects in the nimitta, even at that stage. And you would miss the beauty of the nimitta, and because there was defects, that will hinder you getting into the powerful jhanas. And just even seeing that and applying that to the deepest stage of meditation, it works. So there is no real difference between ordinary insights and profound insights. They are all equal. And in fact, you know, one of the insights which I got when I was just a scientist studying physics, it was an insight which I found, wow, you can use that to the highest level of meditation and enlightenment. And it was the insight which I first heard when I was a student from this famous physicist and engineer, Lord Kelvin. And anyone who knows physics knows that he became famous for this absolute scale of temperature, the Kelvin scale, 0 degrees Kelvin, which I think is it. Was it minus 272 or 3 degrees centigrade? That's absolute zero. There's a reason though, you can't get any colder than that. That's a limit of temperature. That's why it's called absolute zero. And he gave his name to that. It's called the Kelvin scale of temperature. But he also famously said, and again, this was the time when the technological industrial revolution was occurring, he said, if we want to control nature, we must first learn how to measure her accurately. And that was a very deep insight. If you want to sort of control things, even build a retreat center, you've got to measure, survey everything, get all the sizes right first of all, find out how much money you have in the bank. You've got to sort of measure things first of all. And once you've measured things, then actually you can do something. And that was, I thought that was actually very profound, which is why anyone who knows the history of modern technology, one of the first challenges was actually to have standard measurements of weight, of distance, temperature, because once you can measure things, then you have a means of controlling them. But when I became a monk and somebody reminded me of that, I thought, wow, that is profound and I can apply that to the path into enlightenment, because I just turned it around. The only way to control the world is by measuring her first. So what if you never measure her? It means you can't control. You have to let go. And this became another beautiful way of letting go. Not measuring anything. How do you feel right now? Don't measure it. Good, bad, know, joyful, sad or whatever, painful, pleasurable, don't measure it. Because as soon as you measure anything, it gives you business and it gives you a handle to control things. Even your meditations. I remember my first teacher said, there is no such thing as a bad meditation. And I thought, you don't know what you're talking about if you knew my meditations. My meditations are often bad. But, you know, these are sayings, you think about it and think, gee, I mean, that was one of the most profound things I heard, and that really helped my meditation a lot. You know, you're measuring your meditation again. It's a bad meditation or it's a good meditation. Now, if you say it's a bad meditation, then it gives you something to do, doesn't it? Number one, you beat yourself up, I'm hopeless. I've been a monk for so many years and I still can't meditate. Number one, you sort of beat yourself up. Number two, okay, try harder. Do something about it. It gives you business to be done. And when it's business, it's control. And there's no kindness, there's no acceptance, there's no contentment, because now you've got a problem. And it even works with the other way. If you say, oh, that was a really good meditation. If it's a good meditation, there's another word which comes after good. Better. And that gives you more work to do. Yes, a good meditation, but I can do better than that. You know, I got third jhana in this retreat. You can do better than that. Fourth jhana. So every time you measure, you tend to control things. Look in your daily life. The person you live with, your partner. Do you measure them? Do you judge them? Because if you do, then it comes control, comes next. I want to make them better. I've got to make them better. Or whatever, they're really bad, so I've got to get rid of them. Whatever it is, when you measure something, then you do something next. So it's wonderful if you can get this mind which does not measure at all. No good, no bad, no hot, no cold, just like this. No restlessness, no sloth and torpor. It's just the mind, it's just doing what it does. And who am I to judge it? If you do that, it's called letting go. You can't do anything. You're actually stuck. You don't know if it's good or bad. So you just let it go. That's why for many people I've mentioned the beginner's mind. Beginner's mind is great. You don't know what you're doing. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you didn't know what you were doing? Then you'd be at peace for change. Because as soon as you know what you're doing, I've got to do this, and I've got to do that, and I've got to get into jhanas, and I've got to get into enlightenment, and we all got our plans and what we're supposed to do, because when we've got our plans, we're not looking where we are, we're looking where we're going. And that's one of the big problems. That's why people often have their best meditations on their first retreat, and it's all downhill from there. No, not quite. But it's true, many people say that, you know, when they first meditate and get peaceful very quickly. And why? It's because they don't know what they're doing. As I said to somebody, it's the same which I said in England a few times ago. It's one of those sayings you can put on the calendar for next year. You know, oh, Ming's not here, but you know, those people doing the BSWE calendar, it's a great quote for the calendar coming. So in 2011, never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Quite like that one. Never allow knowledge to stand in the way of truth. So knowledge, all you know about meditation, all you know about life, all you know about yourself, all you know about your partner. Never allow knowledge to stand in the way of truth. What's before you? The reality of now. And that's why the beginner's mind, you know, doesn't have much knowledge. That's why it's much easier to see the truth. That's why, you know, you swept away things. And you can't measure because you don't know what you're doing. So that not measuring is a wonderful way of learning how to let go. And you do that in this meditation. It works brilliantly. Sometimes I do that in my meditation. Look at my meditation. Is this a good meditation or a bad meditation? Shut up. I'm not going to measure you at all. Which way are you going to go? No, not measuring. No compass. No tape measure. No temperature gauge. No meter at all. When I do that, it's amazing how quickly you get still. But you've got to maintain that. No, this is dull. I don't like this. No measure. Because when there's no measuring, stillness comes as a natural course. And you go deep, 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 deep. But I also notice, for those of you who have ever studied Pali, this was another thing which stood out when you started reading these books. The word for measure is called manati. It's directly related, it seems, to the word for mind, mano. It literally means what the mind does. I don't know if that was intended or not, but gee, that's just so profound. Basically, measuring is mind work, is what your mind does. It measures things. And so when you stop measuring, not only do you become still, but your mind disappears. It's just got nothing to do anymore. It stops. That's really lovely. And when I started talking about that, I remember talking in Thailand about that. I gave a sermon to the monks in Wat Nanachat about that. And afterwards they said, wow, it's amazing, Ajahn Brahm. You're so Mahayana, because that's almost exactly what the third Zen patriarch said in his famous sermon. The path is easy for those with no preferences, if you've read that. You know, very famous opening line. And he said, that's just what you said. And I said, actually, that's right. You know, there is no difference between Mahayana and Theravada. You know, we're all sort of, it's all Dhamma. And I actually just gave the third Zen patriarch sermon, you know, without realizing it. And there is something to that. It works. The path is easy when you have no preferences. The meditation is easy when you've got no preferences. You know, when you're not sort of trying to get jhanas and you prefer vipassana to samatha, or samatha vipassana, or metta to this, or walking to that. When you've got no preferences, it's amazing just how peaceful life becomes. When you're not got any preferences, whether you're going to have rice or potatoes today. Life is so much easier. You don't plan, you don't manipulate. So it's wonderful to be able to let go by not measuring things, having no preference, and then the path becomes easier. There's also your mind disappears as well. This part of the mind which is always doing things disappears, and just the knower remains. You're just knowing things, but you're not doing things. Because you can't, there's no way of doing it, no measuring device left. And that also helps you when you get into your life outside. We measure far too much. We judge the people in our office. We measure them. And we measure our success and our failure. And just we measure so much about ourselves. Don't do that. Be kind to yourself. And do an opening the door of your heart with no measuring you at all. Unconditional, unmeasured, loving kindness. Even if you can do that, you have so less problems in life. It's an insight which not only works in meditation, but also works in your daily life. So, it's not just not measuring. I mentioned that measuring is what the mind does. And so, you know, when this control of this doer starts to disappear, that part of your mind disappears. And someone reminded me a few days ago in interview times, about a statement which is one of the profoundest statements in commentarial Buddhism. Now this is from Buddhaghosa. And I remember about 2 or 3 years ago, during one of the rains retreats of Bodhinyana, I used this as the theme for the whole 3 months in teaching the monks. And it's a very wonderful little saying. And that's a saying in the Visuddhimagga, the path is, but no person travels on it. Nibbana is, but no one who enters. There's a beautiful little saying. This is not Zen. This is common. This is orthodox. No, dyed in the wool Theravada. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but no person that enters it. And of course, what does that mean? The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. If you're the traveller, if you're the driver, if you're the doer, there is no path. In fact, the more you do, the more you measure, the more you control, the more you drive, the narrower that path becomes, and you're always falling off it. But when there's no traveller, no doer, no driver, no controller, the path is so wide, like one of these superhighways in Brazil, 20 lanes wide. Is it 20 lanes? Somebody said there's the widest road in the whole world is in Brazil somewhere. But imagine like Twitter, how Kwinana Field is only 6 lanes wide at best. So imagine 20-lane wide highway. You can't go off one of those. He said, that's like the path when there's no traveller on it, he's seen. And Nibbana is, but you can't enter it. You have to leave you outside before you can go in. But especially that first part of it, the path is but no traveller on it, is seen. So I said, stop travelling. Stop travelling in your meditation. Stop doing things. If you are going anywhere, just go backwards and forwards on the walking meditation path. It tells you you're never getting anywhere anyway. Where are you getting to in life? Actually, somebody I get very busy, and one of the friends over in town, that was actually Jacob. You know, he asked me how I was going, and I said, no, I was very busy, but I'm getting there. And he said, where? And that was a really good question. That really stopped me. Actually, where am I going? I'm getting there, but where? And you know, I only get back to the place where I started. You finish one job, and another job comes, and then there's another job, and there's another job. You don't get anywhere in life, do you? You pay off one mortgage, and then you buy another home. You fix up that house, and you go and buy another one. First, you know, when you're young, you upgrade and get bigger and bigger houses because you can afford it. And then when you get middle-aged and old, you start to downsize. So, you know, we all get born in a little cot. And we die, and we go back to another box, and it's got a lid on it. It's the only difference between being a baby and being a stiff. Just the lid on top of the box. And in between, we just got all these possessions, get a bigger, bigger, bigger house, and they get smaller, smaller, smaller. Just go around in circles. You never get anywhere. And when you're at school, you learn all these things, and you pass all these exams, you get all this knowledge and all these skills. And then when you get to about my age, you start forgetting things. Did I really tell that story yesterday? You haven't heard that old joke, have you? You start forgetting things. So you start going back to being a baby again. So, you know, this is, you know, we start like this. We start with no hair, we end with no hair. We start with no teeth, we end with no teeth. We start, you know, not being able to walk, we end not being able to walk. We start shitting our pants, we end doing the same. Just go backwards and forwards, isn't it? So that's a great insight to those meditation paths. That's life in that room. And you just go from one end to the other, you end up where you started from. You don't get anywhere, do you, in life? So these are great insights, which are brilliant when you go out to work. You know you're not going to get all the work done. You know it's never going to be finished. You know that sort of, you know, you're never going to get everything out of the way. Never, ever. There's always more stuff coming. So how do you deal with this? Let's be in the moment. If it doesn't get done, this is good enough. And actually, I remember just telling a story about, what was it? Who was teaching in Nolamara. That's right, this wonderful story about a monk over in Thailand. This was Buddhadasa, for those of you who know Buddhadasa. He died some time ago, but he was a very famous monk in Thailand. And he was building his main meditation hall. And when it came to the rains retreat, he sent all the workers home. Because he didn't want any noise in the monastery. We'll finish it later. So all the workers went home. And during the middle of the retreat, a visitor came. And he looked at the meditation hall and asked Ajahn Buddhadasa, when's your hall going to be finished? And Ajahn Buddhadasa, without even lifting an eyebrow, said, it's finished. What do you mean it's finished? Said his visitor. You know, there's no windows, no glass in the windows, there's no roof on there, and there's bags of cement and old pieces of wood all lying all over the place. What do you mean it's finished? And this great monk said this memorable phrase, what's done is finished. And then he left to go and do some meditation. I thought, man, that's really wise, not only in meditation, but also in life. You know, what's done is finished. It's brilliant teaching, isn't it? Because otherwise, nothing is finished in life. But however, I remember saying that one evening in Friday night in Nolamara. And on Sunday, these two Sri Lankans, whose parents came up to me to complain. I said, what's wrong? That's a really nice Dharma. He said, yes, but yesterday, Saturday evening, my sort of 16-year-old son, he went out to go to a party. And the arrangement was he had to finish his homework before he could go out. So we asked him, son, have you done your homework? And he said, quoting Ajahn Brahm, Father, what's done is finished. I'll see you tomorrow. Well, I really got into trouble for that. He had a point. He finished his homework later. Well, what's done is finished. It never gets finished. So this is a wonderful insight which takes away a lot of the stress of your life. Remember that what's done is finished. When I say every second Friday, bright and non-amara, when you go home, look at the... Actually, I shouldn't really say this, because Bianca's going to really get upset at me, but who cares? When you go home, you look in the kitchen, how many dishes are dirty, need to be washed, and how many dishes are clean, and if the clean dishes outnumber the dirty dishes, quit while you are ahead. But please don't do that here. But a lot of times that, you know, we spend a whole life just getting everything perfect, cleaning up, doing all the gardening, cleaning out all the gutters, finishing all the letters, getting all your emails done, washing all your clothes, getting everything perfect and perfect for what? You never have any rest at all. You're always making things perfect, getting somewhere. And you don't know really where you're going. So thank you, Jacob, for reminding me. I'm getting there. Where? Actually, I didn't know. So it's best just to be able to make peace in imperfection. This is good enough. Your body hasn't been perfect. You've been in pain, tired, hungry, or whatever. The meditation, even though we've tried really hard to make it perfect, it hasn't been perfect. Sometimes it's rained and you have to get through the rain to come to the breakfast or the dinner or the lunch. I don't think you tried so hard to get through the rain to come to the chanting at 6 o'clock. But breakfast, yeah. And sometimes it's been cold. It's never good enough, is it? I've often fantasized about, you know, having the perfect meditation retreat center where you have room service. Imagine that room, you press a button and Bianca comes. Poor Bianca. But even that would not be good enough. So you can't make it perfect, so in the end this is good enough. And just like life, for those who are still young and wanting relationships, look, take it from me, because I know all about marriage. Your partner, good enough. It'll do. If you think of trading him or her in to get a better model, no, they're all the same. That's good enough. Your job. Can you get a better job? No, that's good enough. And your, what else have you got? A body. Do you want to get like a gut transplant? Do you want to get, what else have you got? Like a head transplant if you have headaches? Do you want to get a nose transplant like I always want because I've got hay fever? I'd love a nose transplant. I don't know why they haven't done those transplants yet, because they, you know, have all the other parts of the body. You know, they've got to take the liver and the corneas and the sort of the heart sometimes, even take tissue to put on burns victims. Noses, they just throw them away. What a waste. I need one. Anyway, so I do get, oh, that's right. So it's not, you know, it's good enough. So when you have the good enough, it's amazing how much peace you have in life. Because we're so critical. You know, two bad bricks on the wall all the time. This is not good enough. I want it better. Look, even the places you live in now. I was old enough to know the sort of houses people lived in about 50 years ago. Some of the houses you live in, if you transported a person 50 years ago into your current house, they think you're a king or a queen. The amount of stuff you have there. That you can just click a little switch and you get the best entertainment throughout the world on this huge screen. You'd be amazed that, you know, you are living actually better than a Mughal emperor. All the food you can get, you don't even need to cook it, you just call up and it's delivered to your door. It's amazing what you have these days. But are you happy? Is it good enough yet? It's because of our measuring, our expectations, our lack of contentment. That's why we suffer so much. Or we can't maintain our relationships. We can't stay with the person we married. Why are we so critical of our kids and the kids get very upset at us? Why we can't even love ourselves? And we're always trying to do something better, not appreciating what we already have. The meditation you learn here, this is good enough. Just happy to be here. Contentment. Not measuring. You find that gives you so much peace. So much joy. And as many of you experienced today, because I heard you clapping, Bianca, so much gratitude. Isn't that beautiful? To be grateful, the Buddha said, is very rare in this world. And it's one of the most wonderful emotions a human being can experience. It's almost like love when you're grateful for a person. Can you be grateful to this moment, grateful to life, and grateful to yourself? You've done so much just to be here. You should give yourself a clap. Remember what I said in the beginning. When praise is given, please receive it. Don't think, oh no, not me, just other people, not me. Praise yourself, accept it, be grateful for yourself. And with that type of positive attitude, not only do you get deep meditation, you also have a happy life out there in the world. Because you can't control this world. I know I can't control my world. I'm totally out of control. And when I realize that, oh, life is so easy. Even during this retreat, you know, well, sometimes I've been in my room there on the computer because we still have to deal with the backwash from the bhikkhuni ordination, which is still going on in the world. So I've been trying to work with that and look after the monastery every evening. I go walk over there to have a cup of tea and make sure everything's okay over there. And then last night Friday night at Nolamama, making sure, looking at some of the problems with the committee and stuff over there. There's many things which you juggle. But I still manage to come here and give talks and meditate with you. Even in the busy life of a monk, you can still find time just to let things be. And that'll be one of the greatest skills which you learn on this retreat, which will apply in your daily life, just like I do every day of my life. You learn how to, when it's time to meditate, you've been carrying all these burdens, it's time to meditate, you put it down. And leave it alone. And make your mind still. When the meditation is finished, you pick it up again. For you don't hold a cup while you're meditating. One of Ajahn Chah's great stories was, whatever you do, give it everything you've got. So when you're meditating, you're 100% meditating. You're not working. I'm not thinking of the monastery. When I'm working at the monastery, I'm not thinking of meditation. When I'm answering the phone, I'm answering the phone. When I'm giving an interview, you have my 100% attention. This is giving everything you have to the moment. Not only does it make you very successful in what you do, it makes you have very little stress in life. I've often noticed, and I've taught this to business groups, stress is nothing to do with how heavy your responsibilities are. Stress is all about holding too many things at the same time. That's what stress is. One thing at a time, giving everything you've got, means that you have no problems at all. So that's one thing I hope you've learnt here. Being in the present moment. One thing at a time, giving everything you've got. And when that's finished, then you go on to the next thing. So, these are strategies, insights which you learn here. You learn in meditation, which aren't just specific to the path of getting into jhanas. They also work in just your daily life. So don't think, I'm leaving here. I'm not going to be able to do any meditation. It's very nice when I'm here, but out there in the world it's going to go all crazy again. It doesn't work that way. What you learn here helps lessen the stress of your life, makes you more successful, more able to love, and more lovable yourself. Which is why when people go home, that is when you can, if you're going to judge at all, you can find out what's happened in the last few days. You may not be able to notice it. Other people will. Somebody said in the interviews, their boss said, "I don't know what happy pill you're taking, but keep on taking it." It was one of the famous stories. This is a long time ago. They told this to Ajahn Chacko when I was listening, and I always remember this. They told me that when we used to have weekend retreats, this, for those of you old enough, we used to have the weekend retreats in the Theosophical Society retreat in Mount Helena. And he'd always wanted to go on one of these weekend retreats. But he asked his wife, "Darling, there's a weekend meditation retreat, can I go?" And she said, "What? Don't you realize that Mother's coming this weekend? You've got to take your, you know, the son to the dentist. We've got to do the shopping, and you promised to clean the gutters. There's too much on." "No." "Okay." Now this is wonderful advice for husbands. Never argue, just be persistent. Wear her down. So next time, so we can meditation retreat. "Can I go on the retreat, darling?" He said, "No, look, you know, we've got to sort of go to the garden shop. Remember, we're going to sort of buy some plants for the garden, and you've got to fix up the car, and you know, you've got to help me with the tax return." "Okay, darling." But he kept on going like this, you know, every time there's a weekend retreat. And of course, you know, she was worn down. After a while, he said, "Darling, there's a weekend retreat. Can I go?" "Okay, you just go off on your retreat. Leave me to all the work." So he did. Well, you've got to take permission wherever you can find it. But what happened next was the best part of the story. He went on this weekend retreat. When he came home again, his wife just really loved the change in his character. He was just so soft and kind and sensitive. And he told me this to me. The next time there was a weekend retreat on, he didn't even need to ask. She gave him the money and sent him off. Because she saw the change in her husband and she liked that change. And so it was worthwhile doing all the weekend work herself, just so that after the retreat, she got a new, improved husband to live with. It's like sending your car to get serviced. So the moral of that story, next time there's a retreat on, next time get some money and send your husband or your wife here. The reason I tell that story is because it actually does work. You do get a change. And you may not be able to see that change, but other people certainly will. You do become a peaceful, more calm, more happy human being. And that shows you that insight has happened. You cannot measure insight, just as I say, by the profound words you can say to your friends over a cup of coffee. That's never a measure of insight, even though that people get astounded. "Wow, that's a really wise thing you say. You must be totally enlightened." You're totally not enlightened, but you can say wise words anyway. Even parrots can say wise words. But it's just who you are and how you behave. That shows whether you have insight. Whether you can be in a stressful situation and just be peaceful and learn how to let it go. You don't carry it around, just like those two suitcases. Remember that two suitcase simile? Past and the future. Anytime you have a lot of stress, you sit down, you just put those two suitcases down and you're free. That's not just in meditation, that's in your life. There may be a time when you're waiting for a plane to get back to Singapore or to Pakistan, and you find the plane has been delayed. Put down the two suitcases. You can't do anything about it. Just rest, relax, be in the moment. Just means you've got an extra hour or two to meditate at the airport. Instead of trying to kill time, find a quiet corner and sit, let go, be peaceful, relax. That's what you've learned here. Or like one lady, she was going to have an operation for sinus cancer. And she was on the gurney. They'd given her the pre-anesthetic. And she was perfectly awake. Then they gave her the full anesthetic. And as they were wheeling her in the doors, she was still fully awake. They're going to cut me open and I'm still awake. Because you know that happened to some people? You know, they were under a full anaesthetic. They were perfectly mindful, but they couldn't actually scream while they were being cut open. It's the most traumatic thing you can imagine. Being operated on, you're fully aware. But you actually can't sort of say anything because this part of your mind of responding, you can't do. And she thought, this is going to happen to me. So what did she do? She was a member of the Tuesday Armadale group. Said, meditate, let go, let go, let go. And the next thing she knew, she was waking up in the bed after the operation. It worked. And it's amazing just how many of these teachings you get yourself into really difficult situations and you use these teachings and my goodness, they work. So that's where you find out that insiders worked. It solves problems. It takes a painful, fearful, desperate situation and changes it completely to be something which is peaceful and beautiful. And that's, I hope, what you've learned here. At least gone a long way to learning. And whether you like it or not, people say, well, when we get home, should we meditate? You've got no choice in this. I'm telling you this all the time. You will meditate whether you like it or not. You can't stop. It's just addictive. And it's business addictive because it's fun and peaceful. You love doing it. And there'll be times when you're busy and you haven't got the time, you don't meditate. And it's like going without food. You don't feel sort of healthy if you don't meditate. There's something missing in your day and the mind is just not clear and sharp and energized. So after a while, you just realize that meditation is as important as eating. So when people ask the question, well, when I get home, how long should I meditate for? My answer is, for about the same time, maybe more, certainly not less, than you spend eating. So how long do you spend eating every day? Count those minutes and spend at least, if not more, time meditating. Food for the heart. But of course, many people want to meditate more than that. And if you can, do it. It's amazing that how much time you can find if you really want to meditate. If you don't want to meditate, you'll find there's other things to do. In the same way I said, when you're meditating, what do you find value in? If you find value in all the thoughts which go in the mind, then they will stay. And you'll never get peace. If you find more value in the silence, or say in the breath, then the breath will stay. So what you find value in, you find will fill your mind. And the same, what you find value in life, will fill your day. So if the TV is really valuable for you, you'll be spending a lot of time watching the TV. If you find meditation is very valuable, you'll find a lot of time meditating. If you find reading the suttas is very valuable, you'll read a lot of suttas. Whatever you find value in, is what you really do. So see if you can find value in what's really worthy of value. Making your mind peaceful and still. Creating happiness, clarity and insight. It's the most valuable thing in the whole world. And once you brainwash yourself, with my help, into finding value in what's really truly valuable, you have such a lovely life. You don't need the latest TV. You don't need the sort of the new sofa. You don't need the most modern kitchen. You're content. I know this is bad for the economy and terrible for the recovery, but nevertheless, it's great for you. And actually, it's brilliant for the economy because all the dollars which the economy loses because you don't consume so much are more than adequately covered by all the savings the government makes by not having to treat your health problems, mental health problems, and sort of psychological dysfunctions. It costs a huge amount of money to sort of treat sick people with things like cancers, huge amount to treat them for psychological ailments, break up in families, or crime and other such stuff. And you're saving a lot of money for the health system. So whatever money you don't put into the economy because you don't consume, you save the government by not having to spend so much on health. So economically, it's justified to live simply. So when you do things like that, but also that, just environmentally. You know this planet cannot sustain so big a population if we all live at such a high level. So downgrade. Downsize. Live more simply. Not only are you going closer to enlightenment, but you are saving the planet. And even best, tell your young ones, your children, before they get married, become a monk, become a nun. Lessen the global population. Be like Ajahn Brahm and the nuns. I've done my part to lessen the global population problem. And if you do get married, instead of having a child, have a dog. When the dog gets to 13 or 14, they're much easier to look after. And they don't cost so much money. So anyway, you can develop that insight, and if it's very valuable, you'll find a time to meditate at home. You'll find a place to meditate at home because it's important for you. And because of your insights, you simplify your life so you get more time and space to meditate. You can do things like retiring young. When you realize just how little you need to live, you don't need to work so much and have a big fund because you don't need so much. Oh, amazing. What is the old age pension now in Australia? Anyone know? The actual money. That's $65 a week. Is that what you get? No. No one knows. No one's on the note. Come on, admit it, you're old. Someone must be getting a pension. Is it $100? But anyway, people complain, oh, you can't live on that amount. It's not enough to get by. And gee, if I had that amount every week, I'd be living high off the hog. That's much more than I spend. If you look at you may go later on today or tomorrow, whatever, go and see my cave. And gee, that doesn't cost much to live in. It's one little room. So certainly, if you know how to live simply, you can save not a lot of money, a lot of stress, retire early, and have a very, very wonderful life. A life which is not devoted to material pleasures, but devoted to something much more profound, the spiritual peace, harmony, love towards oneself, forgiveness, and love towards all other beings. Why not? Can be done. Hopefully that's what you understand from a place like this. You'll be so happy in your little room. Just a little breakfast bar. You have facilities, communal facilities. For 60 people be living here in peace and harmony without a TV, without sort of struggling or arguing for the last 9 days. Just shows you what's possible. And people know how to have a peaceful heart. These are insights which you've learned here. This is what we mean by what should you do when you go home after today. It happens. You don't have to sort of plan it all out. It just happens. And all the little things you've heard here, from measuring, for little profound things, the path is easy. Path is easy when you have no preferences, or the path is but no traveller on it is seen. That doesn't just apply to meditation, it applies to your life. Your life is easy when you're not travelling it. You just let it happen rather than driving it and trying to control it. Actually, somebody did. They said they downloaded, they actually found the quote, which I said in the story I heard a long time ago, that in Jerusalem, many years ago, the doctors went on strike for 2 weeks. And during those 2 weeks, the death rate in all the hospitals plummeted. Not so many people died. Interesting, isn't it? When there's no doctors, people are healthier. That's what it appeared like. And that was an anecdote, but somebody actually found it on the internet, and they're going to give it to me later on. Isn't that fascinating? When you don't control, you don't interfere, things get better. I've got to be careful here because someone's going to get sick and say, I'm not going to go to the hospital, I'm not going to go to the doctor, and you die, and then I get sued. But I think you understand the meaning of that. But sometimes just letting things be, instead of always trying to fix them up, is sometimes one of the best options. Remember that when you go out of here. You don't always have to be a fixer-upper. Leave things alone. Let them just work their way out. And sometimes that's the far best option. You know how to let go. So these are what you learn, this is what you take away from here. And as far as just the deeper stages, oh, you just can't forget these things. Later on in your life, or later on next week, or those staying here later on this afternoon, this evening, tomorrow, you'll carry on meditating. I know there's one thing I should just finish off with, a really strange phenomenon, but I've seen it happen so many times. You meditate here, and just at the end of the day, you just don't get anything. And you go back home, next week, 10 days or whatever, you're sitting there meditating, and that's when you get your paycheck. Sometimes it takes that amount of time. Sometimes when, you know, you get a contractor and they work here, sometimes you don't pay them for another couple of weeks. So you've done all your work. You meditated, focused, contemplated. And don't think once you're out of here, that's it. The paycheck, my friends, is in the mail. So, that's a little closing talk there on just what to expect and what you've done here, summing it all up, giving you a few extra little tips on letting go, especially the non-measuring bit. And the path is when a traveller on it is seen. Little extra tips for your meditation and just what's going to happen next. I'm not telling you what to do, not giving you plans what to do, but just what to expect, just like the unfolding of the lotus, it happens naturally. You're just a passenger on this journey, never think you're the driver. The more you realise that, the happier and peaceful your life will become, inside a retreat or outside. Thank you for listening. Okay, now, is there any questions about what I've just been saying? Yes, Kamenti. Yes, when I say at the end of every meditation to reflect on what you've just done and find out especially just how you feel. Because this is not so much a judgment, it's like an experience of, you know, what real peace is. And what that actually does do, it gives you encouragement. Now the idea, if you are going to judge at all, give yourself praise. So, you know, for example, this one guy, this famous story, that this one guy in Thailand, and he was a drunkard, he was an alcoholic, and never had any support like AA in sort of that part of Thailand. When it came to the rains retreat, he couldn't keep the five precepts, but he made a resolution, and his resolution was, from the time the sun came up to the time the sun went down, he wouldn't take a drop of alcohol for 3 months. And that was so tough for him. He set his alarm clock to make sure he got up before dawn. Drank as much as he could before the sun came up. And once that sun was up, he stopped. And of course, late in the afternoon, he was counting the minutes. Come on, sun, down, down, quick. And as soon as the sun was down, the bottle of whiskey came out again. And he managed to do that for 3 months. And sometimes people say, that was a drunkard. No, you can't sort of condone that. But for him, it was a wonderful thing. So we didn't sort of criticize him for the hours when he was drunk. We praised him for the hours he wasn't drunk. What a wonderful thing that was. So if you are going to judge, praise. So the good part of your life. If you are getting some quietness in meditation, praise that. Encourage it, because that will make it happen more and more and more. So it's good to judge in that sense at the end of a meditation. But don't judge during the middle. While you're meditating, just no judge at all, so you can't control. And leave all the judging to the end. Like, you know, you're a scientist. Only when you go all the data in, at the very end of the experiment, that's when you make your conclusions. Not in the middle. Any other questions and comments? Yes, sorry.
Isn't measuring conceit?
Measuring is part of conceit. So three conceits, I'm good, I'm better, I'm worse. No, that's not the three conceits, that's the four conceits. I am better, I am worse, I am the same. Okay, it's measuring yourself against others. Or measuring yourself against yourself. And that is conceit, the three conceits of the Buddha. So it's all part of measuring. So do you have a good meditation? A bad meditation? Stalin, are you better than your wife? Worse than the wife? Or same as your wife? Shira? You don't, no conceit, don't even measure at all. Who's got the best meditation, Sheila? Starting on you. You don't get into that, there's arguments coming, you know, that's what happens. So, no measuring at all, no comparisons. And then you're free of control. Okay, any questions? Okay, so you've got 2 hours left to get enlightened. Lunch is at 11 o'clock. And after 11 o'clock, yeah, we do have cleaning up afterwards. But then after the clean up, you know, 1:30 to 2:30. It'd be great if we can do, God, that was in time, wouldn't it? You start at 2:30 and finish at 1:30. But anyway, from 1:30 to 2:30 we have a meditation together, finishing off with a loving kindness. But after that, you're out of here, most of you. Back there into the prison of the world. And every condemned man or woman is always allowed a last meal. And that's at 11 o'clock. So please enjoy yourselves. There's a few interviews coming up, so I'll be out there. So happy meditating, but don't measure, especially at the end of this retreat. What is a good retreat, bad retreat, middle retreat? Just please don't measure. Okay, have fun.